a special episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half hour, and this week's Christmas special is entitled Home for the Holidays. Getting down to the business end of things in 2023. And before we kick off with this year's Christmas special, this is the third year running. I think we've done a Christmas special around this time on Sacred Cinema here on 2XX. And just before we get into the episode itself, just wanted to do a little call out to you dear listeners. To get in contact with me, you can contact me at contact@jimmybernasconi.com. To let me know what were your top films for the year, because we're going to be doing a sort of year in review episode next week for the final episode of the year, and I want to sort of go through some of the big films of the year. I wanted to particularly draw on your favorite films and sort of see where some of the through lines are, where the comparisons and the contrasts should be made in terms of the different subject matter that was being depicted on the silver screen in 2023. So please get in contact with me. You can find me on the 2XXFM website. But if you know, if you've got a pen and paper on you right now, my email is contact@jimmybernasconi.com. And let me know, what were your favorite films from the year, and hopefully we can chat about them next week. But this week we're talking about Christmas, and Merry Christmas to you. I hope you have a very enjoyable festive season. And we're talking about, we always do a Christmas episode because I do love Christmas movies. And this one's called Home for the Holidays. We're particularly looking at Christmas movies that have a clear motif or particularly center on being at home for Christmas. And what that means by being at home is going to be somewhat, we're going to be a little bit flexible on that, or at least explore how profound that might be depicted in some of these films. So we're talking about kind of being homebound, or maybe better put, being bound to the home. Some of the characters are bounding for home. But the films we're going to be talking about are It's a Wonderful Life from 1946, directed by Frank Capra. We're then going to move on to Bob Clark's Christmas Horror from 1974, Black Christmas. And then we're going to finish off with a personal Christmas favorite of mine. That would be Chris Columbus's 1990 family favorite, Home Alone. Before we do get stuck into the films themselves, I think there's some pretty clear through lines, not just that all of these films have some degree of being about, Christmas in the home kind of thing. But when we're talking about Christmas, and I've said this, I think, in every Christmas special we've done, there's always an underlying theme of culmination. There's an underlying theme of things coming to an end, reflecting and reviewing on the year that has just passed, and how we're able to, all the people are together, everything we've achieved comes together. There's that scene in National Lampoon's when Chevy Chase is like, all of this whole year comes to an end, and all I get is, I don't even get this measly bonus that I think there's an underlying theme to all of this, is that there's a backdrop to all of these films, where when we're sitting down at that Christmas lunch table, we're thinking about, what does my year look like at the end of all of this, at the end of this 52 weeks of either misery or great triumph, what is it that I'm what do I have to show for it type thing. And then of course when we've talked about this almost on probably every second episode of this show, when we're talking about being in one's home, we're talking about in sort of particularly in psychological and Jungian terms, very often, depictions of the home, and particularly when you're in a dream, for example, something like that, it's very often the case that analysts talk about, of all kinds, talk about the home being a symbol for the self, being in one's own head, being in one's own psyche. So if we have sort of characters that are trying to invade a home, that these are sort of like bad actors trying to get into your head, trying to live rent-free in your house, inside your head, we use that kind of language for a reason. So I think those are two sort of major themes that we should be keeping in the back of our own homes, our own minds throughout today's episode. But let's kick things off now with It's a Wonderful Life from 1946, directed by Mr. Frank Capra. So last year we actually did a film on a Kafka-esque week, on a episode on a Kafka-esque, the idea of a Kafka-esque Christmas, and we did a film called Franz Kafka's It's a Wonderful Life, which is a sort of a play on words in reference to this one. I feel like we probably should have done Frank Capra's. You should probably almost listen to this episode before you go back and listen to that one, because this is sort of the classic Christmas tale about former Australian one day international great George Bailey, played by Jimmy Stewart, who's a nice man who lives in a town called Bedford Falls. And at the beginning of the film, we find out that he had these big plans to be an explorer and go around the world since he was a little boy, to go to all these exotic places, to, you know, break out of his small town in small town USA type thing. But then, because of a series of burdens and being a good bloke, he stays in Bedford Falls for the rest of his life and builds his life there and never gets to actually go overseas. A bit of a Truman Show sort of situation happening in It's a Wonderful Life. And so he gets stuck in this hometown and you know, it gets to a point where he's kind of contemplating, what is the purpose of all this, given where he sort of ends up, despite what he sort of planned to be. He had these huge dreams and kind of ends up in a kind of the complication of the film sort of centered around, his life's not that great in terms of like material benefits and things like that. And so it's not really just a cute Christmas film. I think if you really want to buy into this film, and I mean, everyone's seen this film, but I think the best way to buy into this film, rather than just seeing it's an old, boring black and white film, is that this is a very affecting film. I mean, like with an A, because it draws on some very fundamentally existential ideas, particularly in light of the fact that, it's 1946, so it's a year after the Second World War, and also after the Great Depression, both of which are explored in the film. So it's kind of like lifting up this question of what is all of this hard work, all of this endurance for, right? If we're just going to be left to suffer in this sort of tiny, meaningless, town that's been, in a life that's been more or less sort of scattered with plenty of tragedy and tragic moments, what was all that hard work for? What's the point of putting all that effort in if I don't get anything out of it, sort of on the level of the ego? And sort of like, what is the good in doing the right thing if doing the right thing just makes you a slave to everybody else, and you're simply being a doormat to everyone else, and then you're just being a nice guy for everyone and never getting anything you want? And sort of, I think the underpinning theme that we're going to explore, at least in the context of today's episode, is how we can have this very insurmountable, yet unobservable impact on the world. In other words, we can sort of change the world from the comfort of our own home. And we're going to sort of unpack what those words mean a little bit more as we sort of talk about the film itself. So this happens, so obviously, it's very obviously kind of communicated in the plot of the film in and of itself. It's got a very sort of cloud atlas. Darren Aronofsky's The Fountain. Another film, I've talked about this on the show before, Happy Feet 2, has this element to it, which is this very much like we're never singular individuals. We're bound in this network, and even the smallest little change in our own lives can have this ripple effect throughout the network that is, the human network. And that even though little George Bailey lives in little Bedford Falls and works at his little building and loan company, he has a huge, profound effect on the world around him, not just even in his own little town, but his brother. The biggest one is that his brother goes off to be a huge war hero and saves hundreds and hundreds of lives, which would have never happened if George never saved him at the beginning of his life from falling in a little frozen pond or something like this. So we realize when we do the counterfactual analysis, even so someone might feel like they have no, it's very much an Ikaru. We talked about this and we talked about the episode many, many years ago now, on the Japanese film Ikaru, which was recently remade with Bill Nye, is the film Living, I think it's called. This idea that you can just be a small cog in the wheel, but if you didn't exist, if we were to take you out of that picture, there are so many ways in which you've changed the world, and it's just simply the fact that you've never seen it like that that is the reason why you can't see already that you are such an important part of this whole thing. But I think there's some really important symbolism in this film as well that pushes that idea a bit forward, further forward as well. So we recall this fact that when we're talking about one's home, and particularly in this film, we're talking about one's hometown. And particularly also, I should mention as well, that Bailey's actual home was this disheveled thing that him and his wife, the Donna Reed character, build up and turn into something resembling a real home, which is, I think, is very symbolic of the idea that, you know, the home, i.e. the self, is something that is at some points shattered, but you can see the beauty in it if work was to be done in it, and you form a union with someone and you build it together and you make it stronger together, and it can be a very lovely thing despite its draftiness and all that sort of thing. But when we're talking about the home, we're talking about the psyche, we're talking about the internal self, and I think we can extend that to Bedford Falls itself for George Bailey, because it's sort of in relation to the greater world that's unexplored for him. And so if we think about Bedford Falls, his hometown, as George Bailey's own mind, the film isn't simply, you know, it's not just a film about saying that, you know, it's okay to, you know, to stay in one's own hometown and still change the world. I think ultimately what the film is saying is that the degree to which George Bailey looks after his own people in the film, the degree to which he looks after that hometown, is really the extent to which he is looking after himself. And so the whole film is really a movie about one's relationship with their own mind. How do we relate to our mind when it gets stale, when it feels like something we need to break away from, when we feel like we want to go on a holiday away from ourself? And so it's not really, I think, a film that's just about leaving one's hometown and how you don't really need to leave one's hometown to change the world, even though that may be true. But really, in changing the world, we really need to be protecting and nurturing our own minds, right? We need to take care of our own minds. We need to, you know, protect the weaker parts of our own psyche, and protect them from the intrusive, more malevolent invader types, like the Potter character in the film, for example. And it's interesting that the town changes to Pottersville when George Bailey, in the universe where George Bailey doesn't exist, that is to say, you know, if his mind doesn't exist, you know, when he doesn't exist, Bedford Falls doesn't exist. That sort of reinforces the idea that Bedford Falls is him, that it is his mind. So Bedford Falls disappears when he disappears. So to sort of hammer home that point that it is the same thing. But just going back to the broader point I'm making here, which is that we need to, it's not simply a matter of tending to our own mind for ourselves. It's not simply a matter of patching up our own home to keep ourselves stabilized, but in this context of us being part of a wider network, we need to look after ourselves, because looking after ourselves is what eventually looks after the rest of the world. If we can keep our hometown, if we can keep Bedford Falls a functioning town, that's what will allow it to its citizens to go out and have a broader and broaderly positive impact on the world. So there's that parallel there. But this is all very nice, right? And I think this is stuff that you kind of see here. Everyone knows that. You look after yourself, you look after the world, right? Is it that easy all the time to look after one's own home, to look after one's own self, particularly in the context of culminating things at the end of the year? Well, at this point, I think it's time to move on to our next film. Before we do, just remind you, I listen to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Berlusconi, for the next, for remainder of this half hour. And please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, and jump onto our website, maybe a Christmas donation in the form of sponsorship, or subscribing to the station. That would be fantastic if you do that. A very Merry Christmas to you if you could. But moving on now, I want to talk about a film that sort of explores this idea that it is kind of difficult to nurture, or better put, to defend, to strengthen one's own home. And to make this point, let's talk about this film Black Christmas from 1974, directed by Bob Clark. And essentially opens with this group of sorority girls in this sorority home in this university, and around Christmas time, and they're having a little Christmas party. And we see from the sort of a point of view camera angle this creepy guy looking through the window going like this, and he's like staring at them, and he breaks into their house. And it's a scary movie. I often think it's funny when you watch like horror movies from the 70s, like, oh yeah, this is going to be like camp and silly. It's like, these movies are scary. Like, this holds up. This is a freaky movie. But I think, you know, I think it's important, at least for the points we're going to make about this one. It's important that it is set at a university, that these are young girls sort of in a coming of age in their life, like they're 18, 19, they haven't fully figured out who they are yet. Learning a lot about the world and how things work, and you hear their sort of political opinions coming out throughout the film. You know, they're all wearing glasses, they're all kind of burgeoning intellectuals, sort of figuring out who they are, and they're living in what is a physical home, but it's not their home. We're going to park that there for just a second. And they're in a place of learning and university and as I said, a place of development, let's say. And I want to talk about how this film conveys this idea of how difficult it can be to defend one's home, this home that they live in. So from the very beginning, as I mentioned, we see the killer is inside the house, right? So malevolence is inside the house. It's inside the psyche of our protagonists, symbolically speaking. And there's about 2 to 3 aspects of this that I think is worth mentioning. So the first part is that the women are completely unconscious. Like, they're not aware that he's in the house pretty much throughout the entire film, that he's able to get in and out, and that he has full access to their home. And so on a symbolic level, there is a relatability and something that we feel. And the film is a horror film. It's exploiting this fear that we have, this intrinsic fear we have of how easily people can get inside us without us even knowing, right? But the second/third, and I think these are interrelated aspects of this that I want to talk about, is in talking about how, you know, how easily people can sort of get inside us, we are relatively weak, I think, in the face of sort of a mental invasion. That is to say that, you know, at the beginning of this film, they're in this state of like romantic complacency where the house is very warm and cozy and Christmassy. And this is where the sort of the Christmassy element of the film sort of really helps it along, I think. Because when you're sitting there drinking eggnog and having a good time, you don't really have the defenses up, right, to figure. And then maybe this is why there are arguments at the dinner table, at the Christmas lunch table sometimes, because we're having a good time and we're sort of having a few drinks, we're letting things relax, we're kind of opening ourselves up, we're meeting with people we might not always get along with, we're not protecting ourselves. And so in that state of comfort, we're also in a state of vulnerability. And so this is sort of makes us somewhat vulnerable to, you know, potentially people that could disrupt our psyche. And also it's important to note as well that the strength of the good guys in this film, i.e. the women, the students, because they're so sort of like 1970s feminist, very, you know, there's a great scene where there's one of the main girls sort of, because the guy keeps calling them up on the phone and he keeps, you know, saying horrible things to the phone, and she like says all these like funny like retorts back to him and kind of like belittles him, and it's really funny, and it's a very like very 1970s feminist kind of way of dealing with a pervert, which is like not to be scared and be a damsel in distress, but to be like, boo. And just in terms of a time capsule about like what 1970s feminism looks like and sounds like, it's a great film just in terms of like a time capsule. Not that I lived through that time, but from what I understand from pictures and stories and things. But the fact that they are so sort of brave and strong and courageous heightens the fact of how powerful this invader is. Like, it's not that they're weak, it's that he's very strong. It's that human beings, no matter how strong you are, a bit like what we talked about Napoleon a couple of weeks ago, doesn't matter if you're a tyrant that can conquer Europe, you are still subject to certain weaknesses. It's a human trait. No one can really put their hand up and say, you know, because in the context of 1974, even these very intellectual, very intelligent women were still subject to this invader. But I think also you can make a deeper point here, and I don't know whether the film slides into a kind of realism or sexism in making this point, and maybe there's a little bit more that we can talk about here, but I think it also sort of, in doing that, it does sort of emphasize the failings of ideology or the failings of political ideology or the failings of culture to keep mental invaders out, right? It doesn't matter how much feminist literature you read, for example, or how much self-help or whatever, or stoicism you read, people are still going to get in your head, right? It's still going to happen. It doesn't matter how sort of crusty or cold or hard you make your skin, you're not going to be able to keep people out from your head. It's going to take sort of a monk level strength to do that, and sort of your run-of-the-mill, off-the-shelf political ideology is never going to be sufficient to do that. And this leads me to the third related point about how difficult it is to defend one's home, is that sometimes we don't even know if we're in our own home, right? So in the context of university, it's a time where it's a very fluid time. We're not sure who we are. We're trying different things. We're trying different ideologies. We're trying different political perspectives. They're living in a sorority house, also at Christmas time. So this isn't their family home. They're living with friends, not family. They're living, and so it has the literal impression it's got doors and windows, right? It has the impression or the facade of being a house, like a child would draw in a crayon drawing, but it's not a home, right? They're not in their actual family homes, but they might feel like they are, you know, the young people living together, feeling a sense of family and their friends. I lived at a college when I was at university. It feels like home, but it's not really home. And I think that's kind of what this film does serve for us, which is this idea that, and it's the same with the personalities they're adopting in their sort of burgeoning, blossoming period of their life, which is, and I don't mean to, and this is why I say that I'm not sure whether the film is empowering or super, super sexist, because it's almost to say that, like, you know, this is really great that you're adopting all of these, you know, very, you know, these masculine traits and standing up for what you want, but it's not working in the face of this invader. Like, it is futile at the end of the day, or at least it's not sufficient. You need to draw on other things. And I also think that's a really important symbol, the fact that the very sort of patriarchal-looking father shows up as soon as the first girl goes. And why is he there? To take her home, to her family home. And the fact that she doesn't do that, or he gets there late, is the reason why, you know, she meets her ultimate demise. So it's so the film ultimately, I think, is giving us this idea that while it is an important thing to sort of look after one's own home, one's own psyche, it can be very difficult to do that, because one, we can never know when things are inside and messing us around, and part of that is because it's very hard, like, everyone is susceptible to that, but also part of that is sometimes we're in someone else's house, sometimes we're in someone else's head, we're not in our own head. And so we can't defend our own head, because we're vulnerable in the sense that we're trying on different personalities, we're trying on different personas, when we really need to be more aware of the fact that there's a truer, perhaps a truer, more authentic or pure self that we're neglecting, that we're not, or at least that we haven't quite found yet. So it leaves us in a difficult situation in that contradiction. Can we move on now to a third and final film that perhaps tries to reconcile that contradiction? Then we're going to finish off now with Chris Columbus's 1990 film, Home Alone. And I'm sure you've seen this one, but this is, if you haven't, if you're an alien spying on the show, it stars a young child actor who's one of the great child actors of all time, Macaulay Culkin, and he is home alone for Christmas. And I want to talk about how this film lifts up both this idea that, I guess on a fundamental level, this film is really a film that kind of gives us the idea that the home is a battleground, right? The home is like a boot camp. It's like a coliseum or a dojo. It's a place where, you know, it requires hard work and endurance to keep it there. But if you can manage to do that, it's a place of great growth. So in one hand, right, let's talk about how it's this place for growth, in the same way that it's a fun, wonderful life kind of gets at that. That I think it's important to say as well that, you know, Kevin never leaves the house to do this trip to Paris like the rest of his family, right? Like, it does give us this idea that travel in and of itself is not sufficient for growth. What is sufficient for growth is that the person that's actually doing the traveling, is the person inside traveling, or is it just the body? Are we just moving from one place to another, or is the person actually taking themselves to a place that is new and is developing? So it's not actually the movement itself that's the problem. And hence that line where he's like, pack my suitcase. Like, it's the actual act of putting his life in a box, being able to make those decisions for himself, that's daunting. It's not actually traveling to Paris. It's not Paris, the place itself, that's daunting for him. It's actually being able to consolidate and being able to organize himself as a human being. But also, I love how this film uses domesticity, like domestic tasks and chores, and even takes the consumerism of Christmas and uses it to make a point about how, like, being a homebody can be a means of growth. So the fact that he's able to go to shops and buy toothbrushes and things like that, which is otherwise completely monotonous because he's a little cute 8-year-old boy, it's actually quite funny. It's quite entertaining and novel and warming and comforting. We like to see someone do that. Or if he was 44, it'd be a very boring movie. Because he's young, as human beings, we feel like, isn't that kind of cute? Like, we'd like to, yeah, good on you for being able to spend the money and do the, like, he literally combs his hair and does washing in this film, and it's funny. Like, it's alluring to us because we like to see someone in that blank canvas point in their life be able to develop themselves that way. But in all the growth that he gains from being at home and organizing himself and engaging in monotonous tasks, it's, you know, to sort of hark back to what we're saying in the Black Christmas conversation, given that it's a place of growth, it's not without its challenges, and being in the home can be a very difficult thing. It definitely poses many obstacles, i.e. obviously you've got the Joe Pesci and the Daniel Stern characters who are invading the home, just like in Black Christmas. It's not all fun and games for Kevin. He actually has to fight people, literally. He has to literally defend the castle. As he says, he's the man of the house, he has to defend it. And so we have, obviously, again, these symbols, like just like in Black Christmas, of malevolent forces. And I think it's probably important to note as well here that you know, they're robbers as well. So they're greedy, they're indulgent. You know, they're trying to make gains through easy pickings in life. So these are all sort of like the malevolent aspects of Christmas. These are all sort of like the Grinchly elements of Christmas. So again, we've got the use of Christmas and Christmas images to make this broader point. But also, I think what's important as well, that the temporary absence of the parents is an obstacle for Kevin. It's more than that, it's a temporary absence. Okay, so it's not that one, you know, it's important to look after the house, but you should look after the house all the time. 8-year-olds should never have their parents with them. It's more like we need to, the house isn't saying that one can look after on their own, right? It is saying that one can grow from looking after the house, but it's not something that you can do on your own all the time. So we've got this Kaskareff nature to his mother, the Catherine O'Hara's character, trying back through the airports and like that. And I think that's symbolic of the fact that, you know, once you let your little one go out on their own, you can never get them back. You never get back to that place of innocence again. And ironically, you know, when she actually does eventually get back, she gets back at the exact same time that everyone else got back, who just did it the normal way, right? There is no way to actually get back to the place that you once wanted to be, you know, what's just you and him. You know, the world is going to pass by, and he is going to grow, and you're not going to be able to get that little boy back in the same way he was when he left. But that's not a bad thing, you know. He's growing on his own type thing, but despite that growth that he benefits from as an individual, eventually all of the family, as I just said, do come home together. The end of the film does involve a big happy family hugging each other in the same home, in the same place. So it's not just that he gets invaded and that's difficult and he's able to fend that off and that's hard in and of itself, but it's also the other side of the coin, that there is also beauty in doing this as a community. There's a beauty in looking out for the home together, not just doing it on your own, right? It is a difficult thing to do forever. Looking after one's own psyche is something that takes a village. And this is something that a lot of Christmas films, this is imagery that a lot of Christmas films use. For example, Love Actually also does this, where it's got, you know, we've got this motif of airports, which otherwise doesn't need to be in the movie, but Richard Curtis puts it in there anyway, because, you know, despite all the journeys in love that everyone engages in, going overseas, going to Milwaukee or whatever, the airport being this sort of this nexus of where all people, you know, can meet, where love is truly found in its most pure form, despite what Al-Qaeda might have you believe, you know, it's the coming together at the end of the journeys that's really the treat at the end of everything. So we sort of pull everything together this week. So we talked about how growth and change can happen in the home, right, inside one's own mind. But that can be a very hard thing to do, particularly when it takes a great deal of effort and resources and nous to defend ourselves from dark forces, especially if we're defending in the wrong place. When we think we're in our own home, when we think we're in our own psyche, but we're kind of in a place that's not really our actual home. It's not actually our own inner self. So maybe what to sort of reconcile that, we need to see the home as somewhat of a battleground, right? An arena that poses a great test, that if we overcome it, it will lead to great growth. So perhaps if you're at home for the holidays this year and you find yourself at the Christmas lunch table, and everyone's yelling at each other, calling each other bigots and Nazis and all sorts of different things, perhaps rather than getting up from the table and leaving, think about what's actually taking place there. You know, maybe it's worth taking a moment to remember that what you're receiving and all that is maybe one of the greatest gifts of all. Well, that's all I've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. Make sure to get in touch with me if you have any submissions for best film or favourite film of 2023. You can email me at contact@jimmyberlusconi.com. But also stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. Jump onto our website as well to subscribe or sponsor. That would be very much appreciated. And have a very Merry Christmas. We'll see you again next week.